Ja, fantastic. Okay. Then I will share my screen. Okay, in case you don't see or hear anything, excuse me, just yell. Okay, so this is now part two of the introduction to machine learning. So in part one, we introduced, I introduced data frames to you in case you did not know. And we discussed the basic concept of machine learning with a focus on a multi-layer perceptron. This part, I agree, was a bit kind of boring and dry because there was a lot of math, but it's just the tools we need to understand these algorithms. You cannot avoid them. Today will be a bit more practical, so we will actually see neural nets and one other algorithm in analysis, data analysis or physics analysis, however you want to call it. And we will also discuss how to evaluate these algorithms, right? I mean, you put stuff in, you get stuff out, but what do you want to do with it? All right. As I said, the stuff we discussed last time, yeah, we will discuss machine learning mostly, and not so much about deep learning. Okay. So last time we discussed the input and how we can manipulated or handled via data frames. Then we discussed the neural net and how to optimize its weights, namely by minimizing the error via steepest gradient descent, for instance. All right. Now today I would like to discuss something that is very, very important in training a machine learning algorithm, and this is training with validation data. So let's go back to the example we discussed last time. Remember, when we had a neural network and it designed it in such a way that it learned a quadratic function, right? Now we want to do this again. But now let's say we learn whatever function. Okay, in this case, it's a quadratic one. And we know that the data we are about to analyze later will be noisy. Can happen. And of course, one of the first things you do is you implement noise in your training data. Right? So you just implement noise in your x values and y values, and then you train your multilayer perceptron again. And this is shown on the right-hand side. So you see the noisy data, the training data, which loosely follow a quadratic function, and then you see in red the response of the neural net. So far, so good. Now what you do is you feed now in, after you trained your network and you think that it's doing what it's supposed to do, you feed in the, let's say, the real data or measured data. You know what I mean? You do an experiment or record whatever data, and then you get this measured data, I call it. And this is slightly different than the data used for training. So on the left panel here, you see blue rectangles and I guess it's grayish circles. So the rectangles are the data you use for training, right? And the circles are the one you actually feed in. And you see that the circles and the rectangles, they are different, especially in the outer parts of this quadratic function. So you see there's a deviation. This means also that ultimately that when we feed this measured data into the network, it might produce a different response. And this is what you see on the right-hand side. So this is also a way to monitor the response of your algorithm if you do a regression, like in our case. On the y-axis are the true y values, so the ones that you know from the measured data in case you want to monitor the network. And on the y-axis is the prediction by the network. And ideally, in ideal world, everything should be on a diagonal line, right? So if everything would be on a diagonal line with slope one, then your algorithm would be perfect. But what you see instead is that for small values, so in the order between 0 and 2, the network and the true values kind of agree very well. And this makes sense because if you again take a look at this plot, yeah, you see in this region, between 0 and 2 on the y-axis, you see that the training data and the measured data are very, very similar. So of course the network will just reproduce what it has learned, right? But if you now go out far outside, like here, you see that there's a larger deviation between the prediction and the real values we observe in nature or experiment or whatever. And on the top left corner of this plot, I quoted a number called MSE, which is the mean squared error. In regression, this is one of the most, how should I say, performance metrics. it's defined like shown here. So you basically take the difference between the true value and the network projection, and then square it and take the average. That's the name, mean squared error. Fine. So we see that the network predicts okay-ish for small x values, right? Because the outcome is kind of similar to what we observe in reality. But if we go more outside into this region here, where the deviation is much more abundant, then we also see a larger deviation. Okay. Again, this is not surprising because the network is just doing what it's supposed to do. We train it on a certain set of data and it's just reflecting the trained data. That's all it does. Okay, this is something very important to keep in mind. This leads me to another important topic. This is validation data. Because our ultimate goal is that we want our algorithm to abstract or generalize on data it has not seen during the experiment and avoid overfitting. This is another nice plot I've stolen from the deep learning school last year. So you have three situations, right? Your algorithm might be underfitting, so you barely represent the data or the features in the data. And of course, you have the good fit, the stuff you're aiming for, right? And overfitting. So basically, you mimic every point exactly, but whenever there is a new prediction or something unexpected, then the algorithm will just fail, right? Okay. And the big question is now, how do we avoid overfitting, right? How do we make the network, or how do we enable generalization by the network? This is done by validation data. So you have to imagine, up to now, we took all the trained data, and run the optimization over it, right? So we fed all the trained data into the network and used it to update the weights. If you use validation data, what you do is you take one portion of the training data, you can define how much, 10%, 5%, I think the most common is 25%. So you take this portion of the training data and do not use it for training. You do not use it to update the weights. You just check once in a while how the network is performing on this unknown data, okay? So again, the weights are updated on the training data frequently, but once in a while you take the validation data and just check what the network is predicting on it, right? And this is shown here. So we have two curves. One is corresponding to the training data. So of course, if you train more and more, the error your network does should decrease, right? Because with every training step, you improve the weights, your precision gets better and better and so on. So this error goes down, fine. This is the validation error, yeah? So remember, once in a while, we take this validation data that is not used for updating the weights, and we just take a look at it. We see, okay, the network, the error here is getting small as well because, again, the network improves while training. And then we reach a minimum. But as we continue to train the network and train more on the features and training data, the validation error increases. And this is the moment, this point when it starts to increase again, this is the point when you start overfitting, right? Because now you're updating the weights up to a point where the network starts to perfectly mimic the features in your training data, which is slightly different from the ones in the validation data, right? So this is why this thing goes up here. So what you want to do is you want to stop here, exactly here, when the difference between validation error and training error is minimal, right? This way, you want to stop. This is the point where you can say, okay, my network has been trained such that the error on the training data is acceptable, but also it's good enough to generalize on data it does not know, okay? This is a very important concept. Okay, the big question is now, okay, how do we do this in scikit-learn? To be honest, it's quite easy. If you remember from last time, this is how we set up our network regressor, right? We define the architecture. In this case, we have one hidden layer with 10 neurons. We have the rectified linear activation function. We use the steepest gradient to minimize. We iterate a maximum 1,000 learning epochs. And then you just specify the validation fraction, right? So in this case, I say, okay, from the train data, I use 50% for training, updating the weights, and 50% is just monitored during training. And early stopping true. So what the algorithm will just do is, internally, we can see it. But what the algorithm will do is we'll start the minimization once in a while, take a look at the validation error, and then check and see, oh, after a certain iteration, it will go up or not change anymore or whatever. But it will basically stop at this point and will stop the minimization. Okay. So this is what internally is happening here. So let's see how this looks like. Again, on the left-hand side, you see the training data and the algorithm that has been trained on all the data I provided. Right? And you see the black dots as the original, and the red one is the prediction by the network. On the right-hand side, you see the same network, meaning same architecture, but this time we used 50% of the training data for validation, and we used early stopping. And just by simple comparison, you see that this guy makes a much better, prediction on average, right? Because here you already see that there's kind of a bias because most of the black dots lie above the red curve, which is not nice. But here on this, on the right-hand side, you see that most of the black dots are equally distributed around the prediction, which is actually something you're hoping for. So this looks already promising. Now, if you compare mean squared error, again, on the left-hand side, if I use all the training data, right-hand side, if I use early stopping and validation. And again, I mean, the situation has not improved a lot, but significantly, right? There's a 9% difference already. Now, this is a very stupid example, I admit. I mean, the real example would look much more complex, different, but you get the point, right, that already you get an improvement in performance just by not using all your training data for training. We can also look at the residuals, right? The blue one are the residuals. Remember, residuals are true Y value minus the predicted value from the network. Blue is for the network without validation, and I guess it's orange or whatever color it is from the network trained with validation data. And you see already that the peak here, that the whole distribution is a bit more narrow, which is already also a good indication that your model is a bit more reliable, robust. But again, as I said, this example is probably not the best one to advertise validation, but I hope you got the idea that whatever you do when you train a model, always have a validation data set aside, because this really helps you to get a feeling on the reliability of your model and also its ability to generalize on unknown data. Yeah. All right. Are there any questions so far? Because if not, then I would like to introduce another machine learning algorithm. Okay, seems not the case. I will go on. I would like to briefly introduce Gaussian processors. Or GPs. Those are very, very, I don't know, I like these algorithms. I don't know why. They are very easy to implement, and I personally say they are very easy to understand. So I hope I will not confuse you by explaining to you how these guys work. So again, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. Another thing I have to excuse for the start of the slides. So these are slides I had to steal from my own talk because I couldn't find the original. So I had to just copy the slides. I'm sorry for that. I don't know where I put the original. It seems to be gone, which is sad. Anyways, now imagine you have data as usual. In this case, it's not a quadratic function. It's a cubic function, right? So the true distribution is indicated by the red line. But what you observe by your measurement or whatever are these dots here, right? These black dots, and each of these dots has an error. Fine. The question is now, how does data look in between those dots? Right? Again, we as a human, we see this, we take one look at this thing, we say, okay, it's a third order polynomial, easy. But imagine you have a more difficult case, then you might ask a machine how stuff looks like there. So we would like to know how the data looks in between, and maybe also make some predictions on the further outside, and also maybe get a feeling for the for the error of our prediction. Right. So far, we just looked at residuals and mean squared error, but maybe we would like to have like if we predict a point here, we would also like to know how confident are we actually that this point is here or here or here. Right? And also, we would like to have an algorithm ideally that requires as less information as possible. And these are most likely Gaussian processors, I'd say. Okay. Again, there's a bit of math. I'm sorry for that. I will not go through all the math in detail, just because some of the stuff is really not necessary. But I have the slides here, so if you want to take a look later on and get a better understanding, you can just go through the slides again and check the details. So the basic idea of a Gaussian processor or GP is, I mean, the name already tells you, is to sample the data from a multivariate Gaussian distribution. So what you think, so the basic idea is that any two points or endpoints are correlated via row, or yeah, that's the correlation between them. Could be 1, 2, 0, or a function, whatever. And so what you do is, the basic idea is that from the data you observe, you can always sample two points from this Gaussian distribution if you know the correlation between the data points, right? For instance, here, the correlation between x and f of x is, of course, x to the power of 3, right? That's kind of, so this is how you could technically sample a missing point here. So again, you basically do the fit by sampling from a multidimensional Gaussian distribution, making an assumption on the correlation between those two points. How this correlation actually looks like, I will explain in the next slide. So the basic ingredient for the Gaussian processor are the kernel functions. Those basically define row, the correlation between your two data points, okay? There are many, many kernel functions out there. I will go with the most simplest one. It's the exponential squared. So let's go through the individual parts. We don't care about this guy. We care about this one, which is the exponent of the difference between two data points you have divided by a length scale. So these are two data points. And so if the two points, so that, let's say these two x values are close to another, then you assume that they have a large correlation, right? So they so there is a correlation between them, right? Because they are close to each other. But for instance, two points that are far away, like this guy and this guy, then you say, okay, they're too far away. They're not correlated within the means of this function. So this is what this guy is doing. And then you have a constant term which corresponds to noise. Right? You can say, okay, I have an uncertainty in my measurement, and this is what this guy is taking care of. Okay. Again, let's say we look at two close points, right, that are really close, so that two close points will cause the kernel function to look like this, right? It's a constant expression, this term plus a noise. All right, makes sense, right? Because we assume that these two guys are, they are correlated by the functional form. Makes sense. Or a derivative, if you want to think of this. Far away points, basically where the gradient doesn't matter anymore, this kernel function is going to zero. These two points don't know each other, meaning that when you do a change here, this guy won't be affected. Just imagine you're wiggling this guy, then this guy won't be affected. Whereas this case, if you do a change here, then this guy will be affected as well. Right? This is the basic idea behind this. All right. And this is painful. I just keep this. Okay. So we just have the kernel function. And that's the only thing you need to set up. The kernel function, maybe a noise function. And then there are tons of algorithms that will do the parameter estimation for you. I will give an example in a second. So this is when you use the Gaussian processor. This is the prediction from a Gaussian processor, right? The green points, and you see it nicely follows a cubic slope. These are the predictions now in red. Sorry, green and red agree very well. So the algorithm is doing what it's supposed to do, and we also get an error, right? So we see the uncertainty of the algorithm. And this is nice. So we can now say, okay, I can predict this point here with this uncertainty. What you also notice is that this guy is kind of doing a very bad job outside 2 and minus 2, which also makes sense because we don't have data here. So the algorithm is simply not able to extrapolate further points out here. All right? Okay. During the minimization, so when minimizing with a given kernel, I got two parameters, right? You remember this delta and sigma n. The delta is the length scale, so basically the distance between the two points, which makes sense. So I found a delta, or a length scale of 0.7, and it currently represents what I put in because I designed the data in a way that the distance between the x values is 0.8. So this makes sense. And this is the noise or the uncertainty, basically the error bars this guy found. It's 0.5, and I said the error bar is 0.3. So it roughly represents what I put in. So this makes sense. Yeah. The big question is now how we implement this thing in scikit. I will present another example again. It's another x squared function. I know you're sick of it now. I promise this is the last quadratic function you have to look at. I promise. So again, this is a noisy data. And we see for small x values, everything is more or less follows nicely a quadratic function. But when I go more outside, everything is more scattered around. Okay. And now I would like to fit this data and make some predictions how stuff looks like in between, right? So I set up a Gaussian processor. For your convenience, I copied the formula for the kernel function because this is what you have to set in scikit. So this is how you do. You first define a kernel function, like shown here, and we have two parts. One is called the RBF. Don't be scared, it's just another name for the exponential squared I introduced before. It's called the radial basis function. This is that guy. Yeah? So when you call this function, you basically call this expression. And you have to define the length scale. Remember, length scale was the distance you expect the x values to have. I set it to 1 because I generated data with x values, with steps of 1. Yeah? So minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and so on. Right? Get the idea. Then you can set length scale boundaries, so with which range you want to vary this parameter doing the fit. Okay, fine. And then we have a second part, which is called the white kernel. Again, don't be scared; it's just a noise contribution you add to your Gaussian processor. So when you know that your data is noisy or has some uncertainties, use this white kernel. And this white kernel is just as I indicated here, it's basically a constant times the delta distribution. So you basically add uncertainties to your diagonal terms on the matrix, right? That's all it does. It just adds a constant noise. This is what the white kernel does, nothing else. Then, once you have set up the kernel, you define the Gaussian processor, right? Again, you define the kernel, which is this guy, and then you define how many times you want to do the minimization or optimization. So basically the fitting where you determine these two parameters. And then you have a parameter which is called alpha. The alpha is similar to the white kernel if set to a constant, but you can also set alpha to a vector which corresponds to the error of each data point. Yeah? So imagine you have, I don't know, 10 data points and you know the error is the error varies between 0.5 and 0.6, whatever, then you just put these values in for alpha as a vector. So you could assign each data point an error, which would then be taken into account during the minimization. Right? That's all it does. All right. So, and once you've done this, you just call fit, right? And then it will fit the x values and y values from your training data, and you're done. And then, of course, this is now the nice thing. If you want to get the predicted values and the errors or covariances, you just call predict. And we'll do the predictions on the x values. And if you set this argument true, then it will also give you the uncertainties for each x value. So it's very nice. And as you see, it's just a few lines to set up a Gaussian processor and to do the fit and to get the results. It's really just a few lines. It's amazing. And this is the result. So you see now, again, in black are the data points. In red is the prediction from the Gaussian processor. And the gray band represents the uncertainty. This is already quite cool. But you see, again, that in the outer part, the guy fails. But I can tell you this, you can improve the situation because, as you remember, we set alpha to zero. So we said, no, the individual points, they don't have errors. They just have, we just have a global noise. But this is actually not true because the data has been generated with individual errors. So if you would just define alpha as a vector with individual errors or best guess errors, then you can highly improve the situation. I was just too lazy to do it. So, but anyways, this is already a remarkable result, right? You get the prediction. You also get the uncertainty. And this is a very, I hope I could convince you that the Gaussian processor is a very powerful tool, but it's also, the math behind this is not too complex, right? The essential thing is just you look at neighboring points. It's similar to a nearest neighbor search if you want. All right. A quick summary. So Gaussian processors are based on sampling from a multi-dimensional Gaussian distribution. Fine. The performance defines on the kernel function. So we use this, you know, we use this exponential squared. But you can imagine if you, for instance, have a periodic function, you can also in the sine squared function as a kernel. So a scikit offers a ton of kernel functions you can use depending on the data you try to fit. You get the errors from the fit or the covariance metrics, which is really nice. You can also use Gaussian processors as classifier. I haven't done this yet, but here's a clickable link. So when you click on it, it will direct you to the page for scikit-learn. Another thing why Gaussian processors or GPs are interesting is some of them are used for hyperparameter optimization. So when you want to, let's say, you have a gigantic neural network and you want to find the best number of neurons and best number of hidden layers or whatnot, then you would include Gaussian processors in the optimization. So yeah, I highly recommend to try these guys out. All right, any questions so far? I hope this wasn't too fast or too complicated.
Is the covariant matrix, is that, how does that relate to the error again?
Well, the entries in the covariance matrix are your errors basically. So on the diagonal, you have the errors of each data point. And on the non-diagonal element, on the off-diagonal elements, you have the correlated errors between two points.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, gotcha. But just remember, it's just on the diagonal, you have the errors. That's what you need to know. All right. If there are any more questions, I will now go to something.
I just have a quick question. I was wondering, what are the advantages of using a Gaussian processor versus a neural network?
Well, it depends. One thing, it's a matter of taste, right? But the other thing, a Gaussian processor, the behavior is much more easy to understand because you know what you put in, right? An exponential squared is much more easier to understand than a neural net with 10 hidden layers and 500 neurons each or so. That's one thing. A second thing is a Gaussian processor, depending on the data, if the data is not too large, it converges much quicker. And also, again, you get the covariance metrics, so you get the uncertainty on each data point. That's another thing. You could do the same for the neural net, but it would take a much much longer analysis. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So by definition, the Gaussian processor gives you the covariance metrics ad hoc. For a neural net, you could do the same, but then you need to reanalyze the data and include some smearing and do some other weird stuff, which takes a bit long. All right. Okay, now we will come to the most prominent example. I think every machine learning book that gives an introduction or an overview about machine learning will talk about classification. So I will do the same, talk about classification. And Professor Dobsmeyer also working on classification, so it's natural that we talk about this. So what is classification and what we want to do? So remember before we did regression, right, where we tried to find the to describe a function, the dependence between x and f of x. Now we want to do something different. So consider we have three species. That could be particles or customer groups, grouped by their browser history or what they buy on Amazon, or I don't know, or could be the states of a car engine. So for instance, if you buy now a modern car with a manual transmission, there's actually an AI inside which tells you when to shift gears, right? Anyway, so these three species can be anything, whatever you like. And these three species are defined by a set of features, three, right? And down here you see a plot of variable or feature two versus feature one, and variable three versus variable two, right? And you see this is how the species look like, or how the data for each species is distributed, right? So we have this gigantic block that is species one. We have this tiny smaller blob that is species two, and then species three, of course. And then we have the same here for different set of variables, right? So we have three species and each defined by three variables. Okay, fine. Of course, if someone would now present you data like this, would say, okay, I just cut out this thing and cut out this and cut out this thing, and then I'm done. Then I have separated them from each other. But in real life, things are not as nice. So all the species are measured within one data set. So when you read out your car engine, or you turn on your detector and do your measurements, you measure all at once, right? And one of the problems is that that all species are not equally presented in the data. For example, in this case, species one is a dominating species, so we have more events with species one than species two. And also we have noise, right? Because if you compare to the previous picture, we have this nice three separated blob, but if you take the real data, you see, you kind of get a guess that there are three blobs and they could be something different, but here, for instance, which one is which? Or here, I mean, you clearly see that there are two blobs, but So now our goal is now to filter each species according to the features I presented before, right? So basically we want our algorithm to be able to collect this blob for species one, then whatever here corresponds to species one, and whatever here corresponds to species one. This is, you already see by eye, this is really difficult. And so we ask a machine to do this for us. So we use a classification algorithm, or called classifier for short. Okay. So first thing is what we need. In any case, we need the training data. Okay. And there are a few assumptions. Assumption number one: we have the training data. Yeah. And the training data set is a realistic representation of the data we analyze later on, right? Remember the first example we talked about with the quadratic function, where we had the noisy training data and the measured data? So we assume now that the data we use for training is very, very similar to the data we analyze later on. So we don't have weird resolution differences or acceptance holds or missing data points or whatever. We assume these two data sets are very much alike. Also, we assume that in the training data, that each species is labeled. For example, species one is labeled with a zero, species two is labeled with a one, and species three is labeled with a two. The label is important because we have to tell our classifier that which is which, right? And because we want the classifier to be able to map features to a certain label, which again corresponds to the species. So we have to tell him in the training who's who, right? So that he does the right mapping. Okay. How do we do this? So let's say I give the data to you and we would like to read the data. And the data is in form of a CSV file, right? So this is quite easy. Let's just define the path to the data shown here. And then use pandas to read the data from a CSV file. And as I said, again, the data is organized in nice rows and columns. And so after you read the data, of course, you want to take a look at it and see how it looks like. In this case, you have this nice head command, which tells you that you, for instance, can look at the first 10 elements. And this is how the data looks like, right? We have the three variables, like I explained before, one for each species, and we have a label. So now here we know our label 2. This means this is species number 3, and these are the corresponding three variables. This is label 1. This must be species 2. And this is these are the corresponding three variables. Fine. Okay. Now, in the next step, we want to prepare the data for the classifier. So what we do is we have to define for the classifier the X values or the input values, right? The features. This is done within this command. So we have the data frame, which we loaded before. And then we tell which variables we are interested from the data frame. In our case, we're interested in all. So variable 1, 2, and 3. Right? Remember, these are the names of the columns. So I just put the names of the columns. And then I tell him to pick the corresponding values. And then I need the target values or the labels, right? So again, we want our classifier to map the features, the X value to the Y value. So we call from our data frame, we call the label column and take the values. And then, I mean, you don't have to do it, but I recommend to do it is to shuffle the data. So we take the X and Y values and just shuffle them independently so that we have, you know, that we avoid bias and stuff and that we have a good statistical representation of each species. Yeah. Okay, and that's all. So we have now prepared our data and we set up the multilayer perceptron. Again, I hope you remember the structure from last time. Again, we define the hidden layers, and this time it's again one hidden layer, just 5 neurons. We use an S activation function, the tangents, and as a solver, the steepest gradient descent. Fine. We use the early stopping again. Okay, and we take 25% of our training data aside. So again, this proportion of the data is not used to update the weights. Okay, sure. Once this is done, we just train the network. This is again done by the fit function. We put in the X values and the target values, the Y values from the slide before. And then, of course, we can ask for the training curve, right, where we ask for the loss curve. And we can ask for the validation curve because we used validation data. So you just do it by this command, which is very handy. And then you just plot the two curves. Well, what I should say is, before you ask, so the network I'm using and using for this analysis has not been tuned. This is something we do in the next next lecture. Anyways, this is a training curve. You see the training error goes down, right? This is a training data, makes sense. And the validation data somewhat stays constant, but it's always the training error, the validation error is always larger than the training error again, because this is the data not seen by the algorithm. Okay. Of course, we could tune this algorithm more so that the difference between these two is smaller or whatnot, but this is something we discuss later. Just for your information, what I mean by error. So the error here is the cross entropy. This is it's a logarithmic function, basically. Okay. So once we have done this, we have now trained our algorithm. And we need to also to understand what the network is actually telling us. So what is the output, right? So as I said before, we have three species we want to identify within this data. So the network has three outputs, right? One for each species, makes sense. And the activation function, this is something you cannot set in scikit. So the activation function for classifier and neural net is the softmax function. This is a definition of the softmax function. So it's basically the exponential of the input from the previous layer divided by the sum of all other three inputs. So again, as I said, X is basically defined by the input from the previous neurons in the last hidden layer. And the softmax just basically what you would do is you take the output from one neuron, from one output neuron, and normalize it by the outputs of all output neurons. Right? Does it make sense? And this this way, the output is always defined between 0 and 1. So when you take the output of your all outputs of your neural net and add them, you always will end up with 1. This is what this softmax function does. Okay. The question is now, how do we transfer this to a label, right? So imagine we have now a neural net. We have trained it, like shown before. We have now 3 outputs, and the outputs are numbers between 0 and 1. Right? One scenario could be 0.1, 0.2, and 0.7. But how do we label this? Or how do we get a label for the species, right? Also here, there are many ways to do it, but the most common one, and also the one used in scikit, is you just take the maximum output, right? Again, 3 outputs, and whoever gives you the maximum response will be labeled, the event will be labeled as such. Here's an example. So let's say you have one event and you observe that in this one event, output number 2 gives you the largest response. And this event would be labeled with 1. That's simple. The question is now, how do we get these predictions and outputs? And this is also very easy. The predictions you get, just take your trained network after training and then dot predict, and then on the data. In this case, X is the entire data we used, right? So now we make a prediction on the data we used for training, and we make a prediction on the data we used for validation, right? This is the entire data. How do I get the outputs? Just predict proba for probabilities. I will say one or two words about this whole probability thing, but for now, just let's say the outputs are the raw outputs, or the probability outputs are accessed by this function. Okay. And now we can add this information to the data frame. And again, this is very easy. Yeah? So you take the data frame we read in before, right? Then we just define a new column called prediction. And we set the predictions here. Then we have one column called probability 1. So that's the output first output. Probability number 2 is the second output of the network. Probability number 3 is the third output of the network, and so on. And of course, we take a look at the data frame again, because we want to see whether everything is in order. So this is how it looks like. Remember, so this is the data frame we put in with three variables, number 1, 2, and 3, the labels we provided. And now you see the prediction of the network. And you see the raw output or probability output of each individual probability output for output number 1, 2, and 3. Okay. Example. Let's take this event. Now, this event, in the original data, was labeled by 1. The network labeled this guy as 1 as well. Does it make sense? Yes, it does, because for this event, the probability of the second output, however you want to call it, showed the largest value, right? 0.9 compared to 0.02 or 0.03. Okay. Take this event. Originally labeled as 2, the neural network said, yeah, it's 2. And we see that probably the output number 3 shows the largest value. Again, that's correct. And of course, the same for label 0, because here we expect that the first output shows the largest response. Okay, makes sense. This is an example. All right. So after taking a look at the data frame, I highly recommend to plot the network output. Not the labels, the raw output or the probabilities, however you want to call it. This is just how to do it. It's shown here. Again, you just call from your data frame the corresponding column. Right? For instance, we want to plot the first output. Right? This is the first output of the network. But we want to plot it for all events that are really species 1. So we would just include this condition, right? So this is condition telling, okay, plot probability 1, but only for events that have a label 0, and so on. And this is the outcome. So now you see the three outputs of the network, right? One for each species, and in gray is the first output for species 1. And this is this curve, and you see it has a maximum at 1, which makes sense, because for all events with species 1, yeah, first output should always, should ideally show always a one. It does that. If I look at output number three, the one for species three, it also has a maximum at one, because for all events with species three, the third output should show the largest response, ideally at one. However, we see this kind of structure, and this is something, this is not good, because this tells you that in this region, at 30% exactly, that the classifier cannot make a clear determination. So the classifier is confused. Right? It might be, in reality, it might be species one, but the classifier will say, oh no, it's species two or three. So when you see these structures in your probability or network output distribution, be alerted. Then you know that your algorithm will be confused. Also, if you look at the output for species two, so the second output of the network, we see that we have this shape. You see that? It's not spiking or it doesn't have its maximum at one, and it's rather roundish or flat, however I want to call this. This also indicates you, just by looking at it, that the algorithm has trouble in clearly identifying species number two. Yeah? Keep that in mind. So, because these outputs look kind of more or less reasonable, but this guy looks a bit, yeah, I don't know. It looks unreasonable, right? Because the maximum is like at 0.9 or something like that. All right. Yeah, and then it's a personal note, because many people, including me, I'm sorry for that, call the output, not the label, the output, we call this probability, right? Because it's between 0 and 1, and most people call it probability. But technically, this is not correct, because the shape of this output highly depends on the training data you put in. It depends on how you set up the algorithm. It depends on many, many things. And technically, you need to calibrate this output. And I put you a link to an archive paper called On Calibration of Modern Neural Networks. Just in case you're interested, they show how you can actually translate the network output into a real probability so that it follows this definition. So again, even though I call them sometimes probability, I'm sorry for that. It's just a slang you get used to. But this, if you want to be completely correct, this should be called network output. Nothing else. All right. Okay, so now we have trained our neural network. We have checked the network output. Sorry. We check the shape of this distribution, and maybe we found something weird or not. Well, we found something weird. The next thing to do is to look at the data before and after classification. So once more, you see here the distribution between the different variables for the different species. So the top row is species one, the second row is species two, and the third row is species three, and then in each panel, you see the correlation between variable two, variable one, number variable three, variable one, and so on. So this is how the data looks like in reality. Now we take a look at what does the network tell us. And this is the data the network gives us as a classification. So now the top row is not the true species one, but it's everything that the network thinks species one. Similarly, the second row is everything the network thinks species two. And then the third row, yeah, species three. And you see, if you look at this, you see, yeah, okay, yeah, the distributions are more like the same, but you also see there's some weird fragments, right? This white part and stuff. So this already also tells you, because this is noise, and noise is always bad for a classifier. Noise is, for the classifier, noise is like, I don't know. So this is the region where the most of the unpredicted stuff happens, right? So these fragments are very hard to predict. And technically, one would have to do a detailed analysis on which elements are missing here, why, and how. But again, it's noise, so it just confused the algorithm. If you would set up the algorithm different, like with a different number of hidden layers or a different number of neurons or whatever, then this might look a bit different. You might have the white spots somewhere else. I don't know. But the important thing is that the main distributions, so the blobs, right, the actual blobs, the ones you're interested in, they are somewhat at the same position, right? If you flick, change the slides a bit quick, you see that, yeah, they are where they should be. Worst scenario is, let's say, if this blob, for instance, would not be here, but would all of a sudden show up here. This is really bad. Then you would know, oh no, something fishy is going on. Okay. So what I'm trying to say here is always check your network, your variables before and after classification. Always do this. This is the first thing you have to do. And we did this and we see, okay, things look reasonable so far. We have this weird things here, but again, it's related noise. All right. Now comes a very, 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 very important performance tool. It's called the ROC curve or receiving operator characteristics. This is a very, very important tool to monitor your classification performance. It depends on just two variables, which I will explain briefly. The first one is the so-called false positive rate. The false positive rate for a given species, let's say number one, is all the events that the algorithm thinks are species one or species I, divided by all events that do not contain species I or one. Yeah? So you take all the events in your data that do not contain the species you're looking for, and out of those, you count how many times the classifier said, oh, yeah, sure, it's species I. Okay, so that's a false positive rate or false identification rate, because ideally you would expect no events of species I in data that doesn't contain species I, right? Then of course you have the true positive rate. Again, you look at events that contain the species you're looking for. So you look at all events with species I, and then you count within those events how many times the classifier actually said, yep, this is species I. So it's here you check how many times the classification algorithm was correct. You could also define it, you could also call it an efficiency. It's the same meaning. And the nice thing is, again, scikit supports this curve or these values. It's a function called ROC curve. And what you just put in is you put in the true values, and you put in the predicted values, predictions, but the raw predictions from a classifier. So not the labels the classifier predicted, but the output values or the probabilities. You know, this is what you put in. And then what it will do is it will calculate these two things depending on different thresholds. So now it will just say, okay, how many events do I correctly identify or misidentify if I look at output values larger than 10%, larger than 50%, and so on. So it internally, it will provide a cut on the network output for the corresponding species and calculate for each cut the false positive rate and the true positive rate. And you can also access the cut values it used, the thresholds, basically. So this would be then the ROC curve for one species, for species one in this case. I do the same for species two and three, and I end up with this plot. So now I have the true positive rate, or how many times I was true in percent, versus how many times was I wrong. This for each species. So we have the black curve, that's for species one, the red curve is for species two, and the green curve is for species three. I will talk in a second about the diagonal line here. Of course, the optimum is that you identify everything correct, so the true positive rate should be one, and you don't make any mistake. So the false positive rate should be zero. That's the optimum. And so the closer your ROC curve comes to this, rectangular shape, the better your algorithm is. Yeah? So everything that converges to this distribution is supposed to be good or performing well. Now, if you compare these three curves, this is also really nice because it tells you the relative performance of your algorithm depending on the species, because we see here that species one and three, the curves look similar. They are not perfect, but they look similar. So the identification performance is kind of similar for these two. But if we look at the red one, then we see that the guy has really trouble with identifying species two, and this is consistent with the observation made before, right? Because we observed that the network output distribution has this weird not so nice shape for species two, basically, right? Because it doesn't have a maximum at one, it has a maximum at 0.9, and yeah. So this is consistent with previous observations. And it has to be like that actually, because the network output is what we are cutting on to observe this curve. So yeah, it has to be like that. The diagonal line. The diagonal line is just plotted here for your convenience. This is the rock curve you would expect for a classifier that just randomly guesses. Right? For one event, it will just throw a dice and say, oh yeah, I guess it's species one. Then the next event, throw the dice again and see, huh, yeah, it's a three or a two or whatever. Right? So when you have a machine learning algorithm, you trained on your data and you see a rock curve like this, then throw this algorithm away. Seriously, throw it away. Don't use it. All right. So this is one very important tool. And also, we will see it in the next lecture. This is also a very nice tool to compare different algorithms, like a neural net versus a boosted decision tree, or a neural net versus a support vector machine, and whatnot. And the next important tool, really important, is the confusion matrix. I guess many of you heard of it. Confusion matrix, this is the tool to check any classifier. And nearly all performance measures, like the accuracy, performance, the F1 score, the purity, efficiency, the Matthews correlation coefficient, recall, whatever, everything is basically calculated from this matrix. So yeah, it's very important. This is just for convenience for you to read on later. This is the definition of the confusion matrix. So basically you compare what are the true labels. So what are the true species? What is the true label of your species in your event? And what does the classifier think? And of course, this definition highly depends on which axis holds the true and predicted label, as we will see in a second. So the question is now, how do I implement this in Python? And the answer is, guess what? Scikit has a function for that. This is really, I found out about it actually yesterday. When I was deriving my confusion matrix, I realized, oh wait, Scikit has a function for that. That's amazing. And it's really called plot confusion matrix. It's just wonderful. And what you would need to plug in is, of course, your classifier, the algorithm you want to inspect. Then the X values, your features, right? Because you need the predictions from the algorithm. And you need the labels, which are the true labels, and then display labels. We see what this does, and then you can normalize it. If you set it to true, then it will normalize it with respect to the true axis. I will explain in a second what this means. And this is the confusion matrix for our neural network. So on the y-axis we have the true label, and on the x-axis we have the predicted label. And we see now, for instance, 0.82 means in 82% of all cases, our classifier correctly identified species one as species one. However, in 12% of the cases, our classifier said it's species two, but it was species one. And in 6% of the cases, classifier said it's species three, but it was species one, actually, and so on, right? And we normalized this matrix such that the sum of each row is one. If you now go down and check the sum of each row, you see it's always. Anyways. If you now take a closer look to the matrix, you will realize that the off-diagonal elements, right? The off-diagonal elements should be zero, ideally, but they're not. You see that the largest contributions are, again, here. It's species two again. Yeah. So in 12% or 30% of the cases, the classifier said it's species two, but it was species three or species one. Yeah? So again, this is, again, consistent with the observations we made before, namely that the guy has really issues with species number two. Yeah. And this is also something I really recommend to you. Whenever you do a classification analysis, you use these tools like rock curve or confusion matrix, or you look at the purity or whatnot, always check whether the stuff you observe is consistent. Yeah. Whether the tools tell you the same, whether these tools give you the same information. But we see now here, okay, everything is consistent. Species two is a troubling guy. But again, we did not optimize the network, right? So the situation might change completely if we put some effort in tuning our network. All right. And this is the summary of the second part today. So I talked a bit about on validation data and how to include it into the training of a neural net. Mainly, you want to avoid overfitting, but also you want to enable our algorithm to be able to generalize on data, on unseen data. I introduced Gaussian processors for data regression. It samples from a multidimensional Gaussian where you just need to define a kernel function and it provides the error matrix, which is nice. We started to look into a classification with machine learning, a weighted data set, a noisy data set, I might say, with three species, each defined by three features. I introduced two important monitoring tools. There are much more out, but I introduced the ones that I believe are the most important ones. First one is the rock curve, right, which shows the true identification rate versus the false identification rate. And then also the confusion matrix, right, which is directly connected to this guy. And as a takeaway, Scikit provides these tools, so you don't have to code them by yourself, right? So you don't have to write a subroutine that does the rock curve scan for you. Scikit does it for you. This is nice. It saves time. You can spend more time on understanding your algorithm. I have to apologize again because initially I wanted to introduce more classification algorithms to you so that you see a variety of them and not just that you're not just stuck to the neural net, get bored with it. I didn't manage it to do today. I'm sorry for that, but I promise next week I will introduce one or two more machine learning algorithms in regards of classification so that you just see a variety of them. I will also talk about other performance metrics or performance measures, like numbers that tell you how well or bad a classifier performs. And then we will talk about something very, very important, but also very interesting, I think. It's the optimization of your machine learning algorithm, also known as hyperparameter optimization. And I believe that's all. Yeah, that's all for today.
A quick question about earlier in the presentation where you were going over, I guess sort of, I forget which curve it was. It wasn't the rock curve, but one way or another, it was you were talking about how there was a spike around 40% or something, and you were saying that how the curve didn't look steep enough around one. And I'm wondering, I guess, is there a way to tell clearly whether or not sort of your algorithm is struggling to classify species due to them, like due to there being some sort of overlap within the species, or whether it's just, you know, a flaw in the algorithm itself, or is that a trivial question to answer?
So if I understood your question correctly, I'd say no, it's not trivial to answer. Let me just go back to the curve. I guess you're referring to this guy, right?
Yeah, exactly that one.
So, okay, first of all, for let's say you have a perfect classification algorithm, you would expect a delta distribution at one, right? Right? Because it would, for each species independently, would say, when he sees the species one, then he would say, okay, output one is one and the others are zero. If the algorithm sees species number two, then output two would be one and all the other outputs would be zero, right? So this is why we would expect a delta distribution at one. Now you mentioned a very good point. You said there are overlaps, right? The features of the species are overlapping. They are not clearly distinguishable. So this is why your output curve or response function of the classifier is kind of smeared out like this, right? So in a semi-ideal classifier, you would expect a maximum at one, and then it would just more or less steeply increase and then flatten out here. That would be like a healthy algorithm because we have correlations and overlaps between the different species. So this is how you can tell.
Gotcha.
Great. Yeah, no, that's really good. Does anybody else have any other questions? Okay. Yeah, if not, we've given a few more things to chew over. So, like I said, we'll get the last assignment out to you guys pretty soon. Send out a note about that. Other than that, if there's anything else on your minds, send me an email about it. And if otherwise, just have a good weekend.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Have a good
Thanks
weekend.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sean?
Yeah.
Do we have a second, maybe?
Yeah, definitely. Maybe you want to stop the recording.
Oh, yeah.